Proceed.
May it please the Court, Chief Justice. Your Honor, my name is Bill Finley, and I was wisely advised by your court bailiff to indicate this before I begin. There is going to be some language, descriptions, and photographs that I don't think I can avoid during this oral argument, and I'm going to present them to the Court. I wanted the Court to be advised of that so that if the Court wished to advise the gallery that I would be putting forth evidence at trial which is troublesome, upsetting, gruesome, that they can be...
What's that going to show? What the victim looked like after they had his brains blown out?
Yeah, yes.
What's the problem with that?
I spent a good deal of time, Justice Wright, on this issue, and I believe that this is distinct from other matters that have been presented to this Court. This Court has been very insistent in their view of gruesome evidence. But in this matter, there has been lines that have been drawn by the Supreme Court in the 70s and the 80s and on. And those lines have been crossed in this matter. And I wasn't prepared to talk about it at this point, but I certainly can if it's easier that way.
No.
I think you've warned the gallery and you may proceed.
Your Honor, I represent Erica Jenkins. And Ms. Jenkins stood accused of first-degree murder, use of a weapon to commit a felony, and being a felon in possession of a firearm in Douglas County, Nebraska. She proceeded to trial last year in January and was found guilty on all three of those counts. She received the mandatory life imprisonment term in regards to the first-degree murder count and successive and consecutive counts in regards to the other two weapons charges. I'd like to reference the issues that I presented in my brief and I found problematic during the trial process, but I'd like to touch upon the evidence that was presented prior to that. The state, in our week-plus trial, presented a good deal of physical evidence against Ms. Jenkins. Nonetheless, very little of it actually created a nexus between her and any involvement. There's nothing that places her physically at the scene. There is no evidence that she possessed a gun physically. There is, and in fact, the state's theory goes that there was two weapons used in this homicide. One, a sawed-off shotgun that was found in the same room in which Nico Jenkins was arrested in and forensically linked him to that. So that seems to be a murder weapon that Nico Jenkins used. But the other weapon that was reportedly used in this matter, and Daniel Bradow from Douglas County Crime Lab indicated that it was likely a revolver. No revolver found in this matter. Certainly not no revolver that is linked to Ms. Jenkins. Furthermore, there was references to social media.
Let me ask you this. Was the sawed-off shotgun, was that a pump action or an automatic?
I thought it was a pump action. There was also references to social media and acquaintance between the decedent, Chris Bradford, and Ms. Jenkins, but the fact of the matter is that it's clear both from physical, digital, or even testimonial evidence that there was no contact between Erica Jenkins and the decedent prior to August 19th of 2013 when the homicide occurred. What the state did show, and they spent a great deal of time on, is they presented three key witnesses, family members of Ms. Jenkins, Lori Sales, Melanie Jenkins, and Brian Easterling, the cousin of Erica Jenkins.
They were all cousins, or was there a sister involved?
I'm sorry. Miss Sales is actually a half-sister. Melanie Jenkins is a full sister, and Brian Easterling is a cousin to Miss Jenkins. Mr. Easterling testified that Miss Jenkins allegedly made statements that inculpatory about her involvement in the homicide. Melanie Jenkins made similar statements, though they related to an entirely different episode where she had contact, allegedly,
with
Erica Jenkins.
Melanie, had a charge been filed against Melanie?
Yes, sir.
And what about the other lady?
Lori Jenkins faced criminal charges at that time as well.
Is Lori Jenkins the mother or the sister?
I'm sorry. I've done this before where I've confused the names. There's two Loris involved. Lori Jenkins is the mother of Erica Jenkins, and Lori Sales is her half-sister, Erica Jenkins' half-sister. I was going to say something to you, Mr. Chief Justice, that if I confused those two names, please correct me. You did. I appreciate that. What happened with Lori Sales is that she was indeed facing two different felony charges at the time she testified, and Melanie Jenkins was facing a single charge, a felony charge, at the time that she had testified as well, and there had been some things done in her case prior to that, which I brought out to the record, where she was released on bond after cooperating in the investigations with Douglas County authorities.
So far, what's wrong with the case?
There's substantial things, and I'm glad you brought that up, Justice Wright. This testimonial evidence is what really brings me to the first 404B or 2, 27-404-2 issue that I had. Between August 19th and August 29th of 2013, Lori Sales alleges that there was an altercation that occurred.
So when did the crime occur?
The 19th of,
okay.
of August.
All right. Go ahead.
Between the 19th of August and the 29th of August, Lori Sales indicates that, or testified to, an altercation that happened between Lori Jenkins, Erica Jenkins' mother, and Miss Jenkins, Erica Jenkins.
So when did this take place, sometime between the 19th and the 29th?
It was really difficult to discern, but it's from the cross-examination and the examination, it seems clear that it happened during that 10-day time frame.
After the murder?
Correct. At that time, Lori Sales describes an incident where there's a disagreement, a verbal altercation between Lori Jenkins and Erica Jenkins. That at that time, Erica Jenkins possessed a weapon, a gun, a firearm. And
now
more importantly...
Okay, all right. That's the defendant, right?
That's correct. And at that time, Lori Sales, testifies that Erica Jenkins said, "I'll pop you like I pop that nigger."
To whom was she referring, you know?
That's what I was going to get to, is that she, during cross-examination, she concedes she does not know who she was referring to. She does not, she being Lori Sales, does not indicate who this person was that was allegedly popped. And then, during cross-examination, we talked about, what does popped mean? And I know that Lori Sales exercised some speculation during direct examination, but when I asked that question, she ultimately said, "I don't know. It was not defined to me by Erica Jenkins. I don't know." So the fact of the matter is, this is what we're left with.
So what basis did the court allow that in?
Well, that is a good question, and one that I struggled with. I believe that essentially what the evidence shows is that there was an altercation, a verbal one, in which harsh language was used by my client, but most importantly, she made threatening statements to her mother while possessing a gun. Those are not, and because of the vagaries of what popped is, when that person was popped, who was popped, we don't have any definitive idea of what she was referring to. And because of that vagary, we're simply left with a threatening statement by a person holding a gun.
Well, is it a threatening statement, or is it more a consciousness of guilt, or almost an admission?
I know the state would love to believe that, Judge, but the problem with that is that we're not in a position to make that determination from the record itself. If you look at the record, there's just simply too many vagaries to make a determination that this was an admission against guilt.
Well, that's not the
but
job
you,
of the
but
jury.
You have testimony from other witnesses that said that at least one witness said that she told him that she was there and shot the victim, the deceased.
That's
Am
true.
Am I correct?
That's true.
Okay, so with that evidence and with that statement, could a juror make a reasonable inference that it was referring to Bradford?
My question is based upon the record, how? The same language was not used during the references made to Melanie Jenkins and Brian Easterling. They're completely different language. They occurred at completely different times. And I just don't see the relevance to this.
I think what I'm confused here, I think you're divorcing the bad act of carrying a felon with carrying a gun with the actual statement made.
I think they're part and parcel to each other. I can't separate them. And there was nothing prophylactic provided by the court to separate them.
Well, assuming you're right, why wouldn't it be harmless?
Because here's the purpose that the state wanted that in. They wanted to have this angry person, Erica Jenkins, holding a gun, threatening her mother. That's exactly the image that they put out there, even though there's no statement against guilt at that point that we can discern based upon the vagaries of what I was talking about during the cross-examination. It creates that image,
angry... But there's other evidence in that, was it Melanie that testified to a conversation that she had, and she said something to the effect that, why'd you shoot an innocent person? Why didn't you go after the ones that actually shot into your house? And the defendant said, that's why he's dead, and that's why I killed that, ellipsis.
I think and I spent some time in my brief talking about this too, they were talking about their friends. I went after him because of their friends, which is completely contradictory of what the state's theory was. The state's theory goes that this homicide occurred because of Curtis Bradford's alleged relationship with an individual named Keto. Not his gang, not a group of associates, not his family.
Aren't you parsing pretty finely there?
Well, I hope not. And I didn't think so. Because gang involvement, whether we like it or not, is a reality in Omaha, Nebraska. And we talk about gangs frequently. There was no reference to a gang under these circumstances. And gosh, it was done, actually. There was one. The reference was to Curtis Bradford being in the gang, Nico Jenkins being associated with the gang. But not with Keto. Keto was not associated with any gang that I saw. There was no issues as to a group of people that had an affiliation with Curtis Bradford. It was one person, Keto.
Let me take you back to the conversation that Melanie described. That's why he's dead, and that's why I killed that ellipsis. That's almost a confession.
Your Honor, like I said, I think that this is a forward issue that ought to have been put before the judge and not a jury. If what you're saying is true, Your Honor, fine. But let's do it procedurally different then. What we need to be doing under these circumstances, like Sanchez tells us to do, is we take these issues that are conceivably bad acts, and we have hearings about them outside of the purview of the jury.
Well,
we make a
this is a bad act. This looks like a bad act in which the defendant is confessing to.
I know the appearance, but I think that there is very reasonable to assume that she could be talking about something completely different.
The universe of 404 is more directed to prior bad acts, is it not? So that we guard against the jury looking at prior events and assuming that the defendant in the current set of events acted in conformity therewith. But, do you agree with that? So it seems to me the testimony about which you're concerned has to do with the current event, not some stuff in the past.
Just when I learned this in law school, I always thought about prior bad acts. But there's nothing distinct in the statute that says it has to be prior. It is simply bad acts. And the fact of the matter is that bad acts can color a trial whether they have
to be. Well, you agree that it's directed to acting in conformity therewith. Does that not indicate a timeline?
It does. Okay. But it still creates the circumstance where it creates a visual that otherwise would not be relevant to a jury, but is bootstrapped in because of some sort of close in time to the act itself, which allows that jurors to see that. And there still is that conformity. They're simply acting in conformity after the fact, not prior to it. And so I still, it's the image of Erica Jenkins being angry and holding a gun and being threatening that I think the jurors were left with, because I think through cross-examination, I was able to show that there was not a confessional situation in there, that there, it is too vague, the information that was presented. And because of that, they weren't in a position to take it as a confession. They just took it as a bad act, that my client is accused of acting in conformity with, though prior.
But this discussion focuses primarily, does it not, on person in possession of a firearm? But the meat of this case is a murder. Do you want to go on to what the evidence is about that?
Oh, I took it very much as it relates to the lead up to a homicide as well. I understand what you're saying, but I don't just stop at that visual at someone possessing a gun. I'm talking about somebody that is angry and is utilizing a gun, because I think that's the picture the jurors saw too. When they see that picture of an angry person holding a gun, it's a whole lot easier to believe that they committed a homicide than if that visual was not shown to that jury.
But it's easy for them to believe if there's testimony to the effect that the defendant said it was her first kill, things of that nature. That really gives the jury a possibility of believing beyond a reasonable doubt, does it not?
They raised that issue in their brief, but I, simply put, I just don't think that we are, you're talking about the Easterling comment. Brian Easterling indicated that Erica Jenkins said that this was her first kill. I just do not see any nexus between what was
or
said.
Didn't Sales say something to the effect that the defendant was concerned that Nico had shot the victim after she did? It was kind of diminishing her act in her eyes.
She very well may have said that, but it was during an interview, not during that instance, if I'm answering your question. It was during an interview done by Detective Schneider.
Some months before your time expires, the other 404 issue that you want to talk about is the revolver before and after.
But may I not answer your question? May I move on to issue of the certainly photographs. Thank you. The state offered a litany of photographs during this, dozens of which were not objected to, 17 of which depicted the decedent, in as he lay from different vantage points, blood, brain matter. Those photographs are very troubling, and they accurately show the entirety of that crime scene. I didn't object to those, and this is why. Because I have respect for the state and the job that they have to do, and they have a right to put on the evidence that they believe is appropriate. However, after those 17 photographs, and after those dozens of crime scene photographs were put in, the state chose to put in exhibits 8, 26, 31, 32, 95, 96, and 97. And if I may show what those
are. You may.
This is exhibit number 8. This is exhibit number 26. This is exhibit number 31. This is exhibit number 32. Exhibit number 95. 96.
Were those autopsy photos?
Yes. 95, 96, 97 are all autopsy photos, Your Honor. State versus Ryan talks about independent relevance. And in State versus Ryan, the district court was actually applauded by this court when they took an individual inventory of every single photograph that came in and said, this is why it's important. This is what it shows. State versus Partee talks about the absolute necessity of the state needing the photograph to prove their case. And State versus Jones actually, in dicta a lot, provided a caution to state, you know, use only those things that are relevant and probative. The fact of the matter is when you look at these photographs and you consider what the defense was, how the defense attacked or didn't attack this type of information, remember in my brief, I indicated that I never challenged the cause of death. I never challenged premeditation. I never challenged that Curtis Bradford was subjected to a gunshot wound. But nonetheless, the state still sought to put this evidence before the jury, which is nothing but inflammatory.
Well, could you, prior to trial, would you know what state those photos, had you seen those prior to trial?
I certainly was aware of the autopsy.
Well, could you move in limine to exclude the photos and stipulate to the cause of death and allow the state to offer two or three photos and then request that the rest of them be excluded as attempts to inflame the jury?
Justice Wright, that would have required me to get an agreement with the state, which I don't think they had any intention of giving me, but I am speculating on that, so that's not fair. The fact of the matter is the motion in limine wouldn't have mattered. I believe Judge Battalion wouldn't have let that in. We sidebarred, and so while it didn't appear as a motion in limine, what it did appear as is I was making it very clear to Judge Battalion, actually my colleague, Mr. Conway, was, as to how I saw these exhibits, why I believe that they should not have been in evidence, and how they crossed the line that I think the Ryan, Partee, and Jones Court had set in this case. I think I'm out of time.
Mr. Finley, before you go, Justice Castle asked you a question about the other 404 incident. Could you briefly tell us what your thoughts are on that?
Prior to the 404 issue, prior to the homicide, there was allegations that my client had possessed a gun, actually both before and after. I had made some indications during, indicated in my brief that I thought that was inappropriate. After reading the state's position in regards to that, I chose not to further brief it because they rightly brought up an incident in which there was not an objection to Brian Easterling's reference to such conduct. I appreciate where the state's coming from in regards to that and what the record indicates. I will submit on my brief without further comment, if that's okay.
Thank you very much. Ms. Faust, good morning to you.
Court counsel, my name is Susan Faust, Assistant Attorney General representing the Appalachian District of Nebraska. The first issue of whether the evidence that Erica threatened her mom, Lori Jenkins, while in possession of a revolver was not Rule 404 evidence. It was intrinsic or inextricably intertwined with the charged offenses because it wasn't for propensity. It helped establish that Erica was a
How was it inextricably intertwined? Was it necessary as part of the factual setting of the crime? And my first question, when did it happen? When did this, sometime between the date of the crime and 10 days later?
Yes, so according how is it, to Lori Sales so, and Melanie Jenkins.
Prosecutor could have tried the case without that evidence. So how was it so inextricably intertwined?
Well, I think it went to the factual setting. The state's allowed to present its total picture. I think it went to identity, it went to intent, and it's corroborative of both Lori Sales and Melanie Jenkins' testimonies of what they heard from Erica. And so I think it helped establish the whole picture, and the evidence fit perfectly with the rest of the evidence at trial to establish Erica's guilt.
Was it some kind of an admission?
Absolutely, yes. It
was an admission, but you seem to be trying to squeeze this under inextricably intertwined.
Well, if it's substantive evidence isn't part and parcel of the whole setting, the whole everything, the whole evidence against her, so I guess I didn't
So see if it had happened three if it
that.
Happened 3 weeks later, it'd still be inextricably intertwined?
I think you gotta take it into context and you gotta take it with the rest of the evidence. Mm-hmm. And here where it fits so perfectly.
So they had to put this evidence in to produce a coherent picture of the charged crime.
where you have, you're having Melanie Jenkins' testimony challenged, you're having Lori Sales' testimony challenged, and then they come in and they hear the same argument, and they hear her saying these things while she's holding a gun. Yeah.
Well, that's not inextricably, that's trying to corroborate a state's witness. That's a lot different.
It still was not Rule 404.
So one of the slugs was, one of the bullets was a slug from the shotgun, and that would be probably larger than a .40 caliber, and the other as a smaller bullet was not a .22, but it could have been a .40 caliber or a .357 or a .38.
Yeah, it could have been.
And she's seen after the murder in possession of a weapon that could have been the weapon that killed the victim.
Yes, it was in the FBI database of 14,000 weapons, only 26 of which could have caused the second wound to Curtis Bradford, and 19 of those 26 could have been revolvers.
And there were no casings found other than the shotgun casing.
And there wouldn't have been if it was a revolver.
Unless they emptied it.
Right.
Okay.
And I say this evidence fits perfectly with the other evidence because we know that Bradford was Erica's first kill. We know that she was shot that Bradford was shot with two different caliber firearms, a contact wound, shotgun wound to the head, and also a smaller indeterminate range firearm. We know that she blamed Pito and his fellow gang members for shooting up her house earlier that year. And we know Bradford was a gang member of Pito's as well as Nico's. And we know that she viewed Bradford as a follower, or a duck, or a puppet, or whatever she called him, of Pito's. And she was upset that Bradford knew their new home address, because hers had just been shot up earlier that year. And Easterling saw her pull out a revolver out of her purse the night of the murder. He said it was a black revolver with a wooden handle similar to a .357. And so then we have this testimony of this argument where she's holding a revolver no more than 10, 11 days after the murder, and she's threatening to shoot Lori like she shot someone else, and Lori responds that she should have shot the people who actually shot in her house, not an innocent person, and Erica tells
her... Excuse me, and the court allow that in on what basis?
As substantive evidence or inextricably intertwined. They objected on Rule 404. It was overruled.
Did the court say anything?
I don't recall. I just recall it was overruled.
But your position, I take it your position, that's pretty close to a confession.
Yes. Yes.
Well, and if the trial court admits evidence, it's admissible under another rule, it's still admissible, isn't it?
Right.
Well, that's not the point I'm trying to make.
No, I understand that.
The state's position is not Rule 404, so the objections were properly overruled.
Well, while you're referring to Easterling, what else did Easterling have to say?
Mr. Easterling testified that it was just Nico and Erica in the basement. Nico was washing off the high point rifle, the blood off of it, and Erica pulls out a revolver out of her purse. He's seen her with it a couple of times before. And Easterling says Nico was thrilled. But the Erica was both thrilled and disappointed because Nico had basically claimed her first kill.
You're aware of State versus Fremont, which dealt with a gun before.
Yes.
A similar event. This is a little bit different. The twist here is you have an incriminating statement that accompanies the possession of the gun after the murder. You think that significantly changes this? Is that how you would distinguish Fremont, or are you still disagreeing with Fremont?
I think the statement with it changes it in a sense. I mean, if we truly don't know what she means by popped, which I think we do, but she's holding a gun when she's saying it, it puts context to what she's saying. So, but we also agreed with the dissent in Fremont. So, I mean, I think whether you want to call it substantive evidence because the statement goes with it, or if you want to call it intrinsic evidence, find it properly.
Thank you.
Was it merely observations of a witness in part? what Easterling saw?
Oh, yeah, I agree. But his is an addition, I guess, to this evidence, what the things he saw and he heard.
I take it your point is, whatever it is, it's harmless error.
I don't want to admit it's error, but if, you know, the court disagrees, yes.
Well, what was the position you took in your brief?
That it was intrinsic or inextricably.
Okay.
We did not make a harmless error argument with regards to that evidence. But with regards to Melanie's testimony, but the other times that she saw Erica with a revolver, where there is not this context of this argument, it's harmless. With regards to the photographs, the ones that were actually objected to, four of them are crime scene photographs, the other three are autopsy photographs. The crime lab tech testified with regards to the crime scene photographs. She used them during her testimony to explain her testimony. The pathologist used the autopsy photographs to explain her testimony about the autopsy.
What was it, were these photographs of the crime scene used to show that this was execution style of killing, where the person was on his knees and was shot from the back?
The crime scene photographs were used to explain the crime scene, but how the law enforcement came, how he appeared to them when they arrived, how they maneuvered the body just to be able to find the evidence they did. They couldn't even identify him until they did that. And really, I think Erica's argument is just one where she's trying to pick the state's argument for it. This was a gruesome crime, and she doesn't get to avoid her gruesomeness or Nico's gruesomeness by having the jury only see pictures of pools of blood and blood spatter on a garage and a projectile on the ground. The jury's allowed to see the body, and the state's allowed to present that evidence. And that includes the entirety of the crime scene and of Bradford's injury.
Well, how many scenes did you really need to depict what you were trying to prove?
Well, I mean, I would disagree with counsel. I think each crime scene photograph, the crime lab tech went through, and she explained why each one was relevant for its own purpose, and as did the pathologist for the autopsy photographs. So I don't think they were cumulative of each other. I think they each had their own purpose. I'll submit on the cross-examination of Ashley Pagan, and I think through the testimony of Sales and Jenkins and Easterling, the evidence is more than sufficient to find Erica guilty of these crimes. No further questions? Yes, from the judge.
Thank you very much. There is no time for rebuttal, so we will go on to the next case of the day, which is Sellers versus Sellers. Mr. Hang, good morning to you.
Good